Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi. And this is The Exchange. As President Trump crosses the 100-day benchmark of his new administration, recall that it was little more than a year ago that his presidential campaign was launched towards the Republican nomination with a victory in New Hampshire. And with several past and potentially future presidential candidates now returning to the Granite State, it just might be the perfect time for a reassessment of the New Hampshire primary's role in the presidential selection process. In his new book, Vote First or Die, journalist Scott Conroy uses his experience covering the 2016 New Hampshire primary for the Huffington Post to reflect on the state's cherished first-in-the-nation status. Conroy views it as an essential first stop along what he calls America's discerning, magnificent, and absurd road to the White House. Today on The Exchange, Vote First or Die, as we reconsider the New Hampshire primary with author Scott Conroy. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me by phone from Washington, D.C. this morning is Scott Conroy. Scott is author of the new book, Vote First or Die, New Hampshire Primary, America's Discerning, Magnificent, and Absurd Road to the White House. Scott is also co-creator and executive producer of Embeds on Verizon's Go 90 platform. He's previously worked for The Huffington Post, Real Clear Politics, and Vice. Scott will be appearing tonight at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College at 6 p.m. And Scott, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me on, Dean.
So, Scott, there have been a number of books written about the New Hampshire primary over the years. You've covered the past three presidential cycles as a reporter for various media outlets. Let's begin by me asking you, what was it about the 2016 primary cycle, or perhaps this moment in your career as a journalist, that led you to write this book now?
Yeah, you're right. There are other books that cover the history of the New Hampshire primary very well. And, of course, there are plenty of campaign books that come out every 4 years that take a look at that particular election. So what I wanted to do with this book was to sort of combine those two ideas. You know, the very first day when I was a political reporter in 2007 covering Mitt Romney's first campaign for CBS News, I was at a Labor Day parade in Milford, New Hampshire, as I recall, and I just immediately got the sense that there was something a little bit different, something a little bit special about New Hampshire, even compared to Iowa, frankly.
Sure.
Politics, you know, as you and many of your listeners will know, runs through the bloodstream in New Hampshire unlike anywhere else. So what I wanted to do with the book was to create kind of a tapestry and a first-person narrative account of the 2016 campaign, but to also weave through that some of the stories from past campaigns and some of my favorite anecdotes, whether they're funny or particularly revealing about the primary or just kind of fascinating, in order to create, you know, a single first-person narrative. It's not meant to be a comprehensive account of the New Hampshire primary, but I just wanted to really get at the essence of the primary itself.
Can you say a little bit about your experiences? You've worked with a number of different media outlets, maybe to give listeners a sense of the kind of work that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a little bit of everything, actually, really. You know, I've, as I said, I started my career in journalism at CBS News, so I was what's called a campaign embed. The National News Network sent out a young producer to be embedded with one particular campaign, and mine was Romney, and this was 2008, his first campaign. I covered Sarah Palin after that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when I worked for Real Clear Politics in the Huffington Post, I was really just a straightforward print reporter. I also did a documentary series for the Huffington Post, so that was kind of one of my first forays into the territory that I'm exploring now, which is more narrative TV and scripted TV and film. So I have done a little bit of everything. So, you know, it's all I always tell people that every form of journalism and every form of writing has some similarities. I think as a print reporter, which I was able to kind of recapture some of doing in the course of reporting and researching this book, it's a little bit easier sometimes to get information from people and to get some of those great scenes because people are a little bit, you know, they let their guards down when there's not a camera in their face. So I find that that can often be the best method of gaining the best information for a book like this.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it a little bit later on, but you were quite industrious in getting into various town hall meetings and rallies when maybe that wasn't necessarily what the campaigns wanted. It's very
always the goal. Right. Do what the campaigns don't want.
Right. I should also mention, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're co-author of the book Sarah from Alaska?
Yeah. It's sort of a biography about Sarah Palin that came out a few years ago now. But I wrote that book with my colleague Shoshana Walsh.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you had followed Palin after the primary.
Yeah, and I remember in 2008 thinking that that was going to be the most kind of insane election that we'd ever have, and here we are. Proved to be untrue.
Yeah. In writing the book, in addition to kind of providing some insight into your own experience on the campaign trail here, did you have any intention or objectives to sort of weigh in on the debate on New Hampshire's first in the nation status and the whole debate about how we select our presidents?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I had to kind of weigh in on that and really to take a position in the end, which ends up being kind of a Churchillian one, which is that the New Hampshire primary is probably the worst possible way to begin the process of picking a president in earnest, except for all of the other possible ways of doing it. So I think that there are flaws, and, you know, as everyone in New Hampshire knows, the other 49 states or the other 48 states, at least if you don't consider Iowa, look at this thing and think, you know, why should they deserve this status? I mean, you know, New Hampshire is a state that demographically is not representative. It doesn't look like the rest of the country. It's, I think, 93-94% white.
That's right.
You know, why should they have this special privileged spot on the calendar every 4 years? And I think you have to acknowledge that it's not fair to the rest of the country. But that, you know, the alternatives really are worse. If you had a national primary, whoever had the most money would win every single time. You know, if you had revolving, a lot of people propose this idea of having states kind of take turns doing
these
it.
These are the regional rotating
regional primary, which sounds like a good idea in theory. But I think for those of us that have covered, you know, let's say like the Nevada caucuses and other states that have moved up earlier in the calendar, it's just not the same because there's not that tradition. There's not that history. So people in those states don't tend to take it as seriously as they do in New Hampshire. I mean, New Hampshire residents should be proud that yet again they had the highest percentage turnout of registered voters in the country during the primaries and caucuses. So I think you can't really just replicate that at a drop of a hat.
We're talking with author Scott Conroy today. He's written a new book called Vote First or Die. It's about the 2016 New Hampshire primary and the presidential selection process. Join in with your stories and impressions of the first in the nation primary. You can ask Scott some questions. You can call us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. And I will get that right here in the studio. So let's talk a little bit more about this issue of New Hampshire's place in the process. And it seemed to me that kind of one of the messages coming out of your book, and I also read you recently had a piece in Real Clear Politics about this. You know, the traditional argument in favor of New Hampshire is that, you know, it may not be demographically representative. It may be, you know, smaller and rural, but that it winnows the field in effective ways. And you take a little bit of a different tack and focus more on its ability to kind of distill the national mood. Say a little bit about those two issues.
Well, I mean, on the former part, I think 2016 is a perfect example of this. You had Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were two candidates that almost no one at a national level gave any shot whatsoever of not only winning the New Hampshire primary, but of coming anywhere close. And that both of those guys, you know, Bernie won by 22 points over Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump had a really easy victory himself that really propelled him towards the White House. So New Hampshire, to me, in 2016, and having spent a lot of time in the state in the year and a half really leading up to the primary, right. You could just pick up in the air how angry people really were and how this kind of grassroots anti-establishment activism on both sides and both political parties, how real it was. I mean, I would run into people all the time who were trying to decide between Bernie and Trump, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, unaffiliated voters can vote in either primary. Right. So to me, that told me something, that something was really different this time around. And I think the establishments on both sides and the national media writ large were really slow to pick up on that. They did pick up on it eventually, but even beyond New Hampshire, the narrative, especially on the Republican side, as you'll recall, going into states like South Carolina, a lot of times the headline out of South Carolina was Marco Rubio finishes third. And, mm-hmm. you know, it seems a little ridiculous in retrospect that even after winning New Hampshire and winning other states, you know, one after the other, that a lot of people still didn't think Donald Trump was going to win the right. nomination until, you know, the week of the convention, really. So I think New Hampshire, to me, people would be wise to pay more attention to what's going on in a state like New Hampshire. And it's easier to pick up on those dynamics if you're actually on the ground and in a smaller state like New Hampshire, whereas it can be hard to pick up on that national mood that's a little bit, right. you know, hard to synthesize if you can't actually see it with your own eyes. And New Hampshire provides that opportunity to do.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting because we traditionally associate the New Hampshire primary with the idea that a, you know, relatively unknown candidate can start out and kind of work their way into contention. And you mentioned Bernie Sanders. And just to recount my own experience, I did a couple interviews with him over the course of the primary. And the first time was when he was first deciding whether or not he was even going to run. And we did a live interview at the Barley House, which, you know, is the pub across the street from the state house, and you know, there were lots of people in the restaurant, and nobody really gave us a second thought. They just kind of looked over and kept walking. You know, the month before the primary, it was standing room only. So, right. So I mean, it sounds like your experience is similar in that even though perhaps this particular primary was about distilling the national mood,
yeah.
You still have this opportunity for outsiders to kind of work their way up through the process.
And I think, and there's an argument that a lot of people will make that, look, Donald Trump won the New Hampshire primary and ultimately the presidency through a strategy that really had nothing to do with the way that, you know, people in New Hampshire have always said you have to run in New Hampshire, which is to do these small events, look people in the eye, meet them three times, show up at the town hall meetings. Trump didn't do any of that stuff, really, until the very end. And even at that point, it was more of just kind of a photo op. But I do think that Trump is kind of a unique figure that probably won't be replicated anytime soon. Mm-hmm. By virtue of The Apprentice, you know, he was in people's living rooms for a decade leading up to the primary. So people felt like they knew him. They didn't have to meet him face to face. They had been, again, inviting him into their living rooms for a long time. And that's not something that other candidates are going to have the luxury of having, that kind of deep personal connection with people without actually meeting them face to face. And I think someone like Bernie Sanders really, you know, he did big events, of course, you know, he drew big crowds. But people have to remember what it was like when the Democratic race began. I mean, Hillary Clinton had the entire Democratic establishment lined up. And I'm just talking about New Hampshire. I frankly didn't think that you know, had much of a chance at all of not just losing, but of winning by less than, you know, 15, 20 points.
Right.
And it's really remarkable what Bernie was able to do from the ground up in New Hampshire. And that really was, you know, the old-fashioned grassroots organizing.
We're talking about the New Hampshire primary today with author Scott Conroy. His new book is Vote First or Die on the 2016 New Hampshire presidential primary. You can call in with your questions, your comments, your reflections on New Hampshire primary and the presidential selection process at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org, and I will get that right here in the studio. Before we move on, I want to circle back just briefly to this issue of other possible ways of selecting our presidents. And you mentioned that the two most common ones are this idea of a rotating schedule of regional primaries, and in particular, we often hear about a national primary day. I just sort of want to touch briefly on what the underlying issue is here that in terms of both continuity, and I guess with the national process, it would be the impact of money. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I mean, basically, it comes down to this. If you had a national primary, you know, you would basically be replicating what happens in the general election. Everyone just comes out to vote in the same day. But actually, it would be in a lot of ways a larger scale than the general election because, of course, as Donald Trump showed us, general elections are won in the states. And so, you know, you have to campaign in individual states in order to win. If there were just one national primary and whoever got the most votes becomes the party's nominee, then, you know, whoever is going to be the most famous person at that time or whoever has most name recognition or, you know, campaigns the hardest in New York City and Los Angeles is probably going to win. So I don't think that's a great solution. That's not a great way to, begin the process of winnowing the field. And I think if you had, the other major proposal that's been out there is either a regional primary where you have, let's say you divide the country up into four regions, and that's a little bit better because that way, it is a little bit of a smaller scale and you campaign in individual regions.
And you might have a mix of small and large states in each region.
Yeah, exactly. And that's probably a better proposal than than the third one, which is, to have a rotating list of states. So, you know, Arizona goes first one year and then Wyoming goes first another year. And again, I think the biggest problem with that one is early on in the campaign cycle, it's difficult to get people to pay attention, typically. I mean, 2016, again, was a unique situation because I think people were tuned into politics earlier than usual. It was such a it was almost, it was entertainment for people, frankly, because it was such an unusual an historic election in so many ways. That's not typically what you have, and typically people are not paying close attention early on. So states that are not used to holding a primary early on, unlike New Hampshire, it's going to be hard to get that level of civic engagement that you just always get in New Hampshire every 4 years because people in New Hampshire know that their vote means, frankly, more than it does elsewhere. And they take the responsibility really seriously. And it's not that people elsewhere don't, but it's just different. You know, overall, it's a different level of engagement, I think. And it would be somewhat dangerous to lose that. I think now more than ever, it's important to preserve certain institutions in our politics.
And I think you end somewhere towards the end of your book, you mentioned that, despite kind of the criticisms of New Hampshire for representativeness, et cetera, that, you know, at this point, there's such an institutional memory that to kind of rebuild that with these regional primaries would be potentially problematic.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk to your Secretary of State, Bill Gardner, about this subject for hours and hours. I think the way he puts it is if you plant a tree, in the middle of a city, it won't grow right. But if you plant it in a forest where it's supposed to grow and where there are lots of other trees that have been there for a long time, it'll grow. And there's a reason why certain things are the way that they are and have been that way. And that doesn't mean that, you know, every tradition is worth preserving and that the country shouldn't change and adapt to modernity. I think New Hampshire is going to have probably its most difficult time in the history of the primary so far. I mean, for 100 years, they have kept that first-in-the-nation status, and it hasn't always been easy. In fact, more often than not, it's been very challenging. There's always other states. There's always political
Scott,
parties
let me,
that come in.
Let me jump in 1 second. We need to take a quick break, but much more coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. The This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, Scott Conroy is with us. He's written a new book on the New Hampshire primary called Vote First or Die. You can join us for the conversation. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can respond to us on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. My guest is Scott Conroy, author of Vote First or Die. Scott is also creator of a 7-part Huffington Post documentary series about life on the 2016 campaign trail in New Hampshire. I highly recommend it. I use it in my own classes. He was a national political reporter for the Huffington Post, Real Clear Politics, and a campaign embedded reporter for CBS News. So, Scott, let's segue now and talk. We've talked about the process. Let's talk about some of the individuals, and in particular, the central component of New Hampshire traditionally, which is the retail politics experience between voters and candidates. And I want to talk first a little historically about sort of the two of the archetypes for this mode of retail politics. Jimmy Carter in the 1970s, following the shift to primaries and caucuses, and then John McCain, who in many senses emerges as kind of the archetype of New Hampshire retail politics in 2000 and 2008. So start a little bit with Carter. I think a lot of people don't realize how central he was to kind of the early stages of the, you know, the New Hampshire primary has been around for 100 years, but right. Kind of the modern primary, Carter really pioneered some of the traditions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things that surprised me in doing research for this book, and something I didn't really fully appreciate before, was that before 1976, you know, the New Hampshire primary had been around for more than a half a century, but it wasn't really what it's become. And candidates would campaign in New Hampshire, you know, for maybe a couple weeks at a time. It just the level of intensity wasn't there. It wasn't what it is now. And I think Jimmy Carter was one of the first candidates really to come in as an unknown in New Hampshire, very, kind of obscure southern governor, and introduced himself, made some good, powerful friends in the Democratic Party in the state, and just really grinded it out for about a year leading up to the primary, doing those small events that we've all come to know and be, you know, kind of a part of that New Hampshire lore, which, again, you know, sometimes those kinds of candidates would come around, but they didn't work as hard as Carter really did in 76. And of course, you know, in for the first few decades of the primary, voters in the state didn't even vote directly for presidential candidates. It was only in 1949 that the state legislature passed a law that allowed candidate slate to be listed. So you would, before that, you just voted for delegates. So that was, again, another reason why the level of intensity wasn't quite there. But Jimmy Carter came in as someone from the Deep South who culturally didn't have a lot in common with the state, but was able to do very well just by, I think, virtue of working harder than the rest of the field. And that's a model that's you know, really made a deep impact in the decades since then.
Yeah, I mean, the classic story is that he just kind of walked around saying to people, "Hi, I'm Jimmy Carter. I'm running for president," and handing them a bag of peanuts.
Right. Yeah, and there was some controversy about whether those peanuts might be considered a bribe. So I think he had to stop doing that eventually.
That's a low voter threshold if the peanuts will tip the scales. One of the central kind of retail politics stories in your book that you kind of weave through it is John McCain, both. Yeah. Both in his two runs for president, but also as a cheerleader for Lindsey Graham in 2016.
Yeah.
So say a little bit about what is it about McCain's understanding of how the primary works that was so central to both his big win in 2000 and then his comeback in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Jimmy Carter kind of in some ways maybe invented the modern primary way of campaigning for a candidate, and then John McCain took it to a new level. I mean, of course, everyone, when they think about the New Hampshire primary, thinks about those town hall meetings. And, you know, people were having town hall meetings before John McCain, but John McCain was the guy in 1999 and early 2000 that made them the central component of his campaign. He is someone that, you know, loves the New Hampshire primary, I think, more than just about anyone alive. I think if it were up to John McCain, he would be campaigning in New Hampshire right now. And again, he's kind of the quintessential, you know, in both 2000 and 2008, when he won the New Hampshire primary in both of those campaigns. At various points, you know, he was a heavy underdog and really just, you know, lived by the land. As they
Especially in 2008, I recall,
yeah.
People were writing him off, and he literally just had to cut his staff and regroup.
Yeah. Well, in 2000, you know, he began as a heavy underdog and then slowly built himself up in New Hampshire to the point where he easily won against, you know, George W. Bush. You're right. In 2008, you know, he kind of started off as the favorite, the guy who had been there before and won it, had the most name recognition probably in the field. And his campaign in the summer of 2007 really just collapsed almost entirely. And then John McCain got to go back and run the way that he wanted to run, which was low budget, just grinding it out, meeting small groups of people at a time. And that was, of course, the recipe for success for him. So I think he to me is kind of really the ultimate figure in New Hampshire, and someone that kind of embodies the spirit of the primary as much as anyone.
One other person, people may be surprised to hear this. You know, I think there's certainly some merit to it. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who ran for president in 2016. In your book, his retail skills receive high praise. You say he exhibited the rhetorical prowess of a once-in-a-generation politician. I've talked about this a lot over the years. Do you think he missed his opportunity in 2012? And what happened to him in 2016, despite having these impressive retail skills? It just didn't come together for him.
Yeah, I do think he missed his opportunity in 2012. I think he would have had a really good shot at winning the nomination in 2012. As you'll recall, there were a lot of powerful, influential Republicans
that
were
begging him to
run
for president
into the campaign. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's probably a good lesson for politicians. And, you know, you look at someone like Barack Obama, who a lot of people were telling him not to run in 2008. You're too young. Hillary's got this in the bag. Wait your turn. And, you know, he was like, no, I see this is my opportunity now. And these don't come around that often. Who knows what the situation is going to be like in 4 years. So he went for it. And, you know, Christie would have been wise to do that for sure. I think in 2016, obviously the Bridgegate issue hurt him tremendously in the end. It was really hard for him to move on from that. And then, you know, he was a great retail candidate and had this attitude about him that was appealing in New Hampshire, kind of the Northeastern tough guy thing, somewhat of a loud mouth in an appealing way to a lot of people. But then when you have Donald Trump also in the race, you know, it kind of negates that that strength when you have someone that sort of highlights those qualities and then takes them to a whole other level.
Right. In a weird way, he was no longer unique.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think, you know, yeah, it was absolutely the wrong time for him in 2016. It probably would have been the right time for him in 2012.
We're talking about the New Hampshire primary in a new book, Vote First or Die, with author Scott Conroy. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk a little bit about John Kasich. You know, it's interesting. I think this highlights the larger issue of candidates who hope that, you know, maybe a second place finish. And Kasich had a second place finish. You know, we know the famous Bill Clinton comeback kid. He finished
right.
Second to Paul Tsongas. Say a little bit of something. Kasich's sort of an interesting candidate, but also just the sort of power of the second place finish and momentum.
Yeah, well, there's second place finishes in New Hampshire, and then there's second place finishes in New Hampshire that, you know, are in all caps, and it really just totally depends on what kind of a second place finish you have. Bill Clinton in 92 finished in second. Like the political genius that he is, was able to spin that into a victory, and I think a lot of people who probably have kind of, you know, hazy memories of that campaign probably remember him as having won because it seemed that way, even though he didn't win. He had come back from the political dead and made a close race of it. Someone like John Kasich, you know, it was really impressive for him to finish in second in New Hampshire. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that for someone that was running in such a crowded field of, you know, big name candidates as he was. And again, Kasich really did it the old fashioned John McCain style way, I think he did over 100 town halls in the state, was just, you know, really just grinding it out, riding around on his bus, meeting as many people as he could face to face, didn't have a lot of money, really, didn't have a big media strategy. But the problem for him was that he had nowhere to go after New Hampshire. And you can't just be, you know, a one-state candidate. And I think, you know, John McCain learned that the hard way in 2000. And then in 2008, he adjusted, and he had a strategy beyond New Hampshire that was able to, you know, win him the nomination in the end. John Kasich was handicapped by his lack of funds going forward, and basically just not really being politically aligned with what the mainstream and sort of the activist wing of the Republican Party in 2016 was hoping for. I mean, he was just out of step with that beyond New Hampshire. So that was why he stopped gaining any momentum whatsoever after primary day.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, your experience with John Kasich was very similar to mine. He could be both very accessible and also very difficult. But I sensed, you know, sort of over the time of his experience here, he really sort of embraced it. As I think you mentioned as well, he just seemed a lot more relaxed as we got closer to the primary. Was that your sense?
Yeah, I think he's someone that he's kind of an emotional guy, and he kind of takes everything in. It seems to me, and really tries to absorb what's going on around him, unlike a lot of politicians that are always just kind of in type A, go, go, go mode. I do think that the primary probably had a deep impact on him, and I know he's actually coming back up to New Hampshire this week.
To talk about his book.
At the Institute of Politics later in the week, and so clearly he had a great experience here and wants to come back. I think that's someone that's probably looking at running again. If he were to do that, I'm sure New Hampshire would be at the center of his strategy again. Yeah. He'd just have to try to find a way to build out beyond that.
Do you think there's a potential that he would consider primarying Donald Trump? I mean, what conditions do you think would trigger that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think either primarying Trump or running as an independent. It's so early to begin these discussions, but I would be pretty shocked if Trump does not have a primary challenge in 2020 if he does indeed run for re-election. I mean, it just seems like someone will jump at that opportunity, and I could see John Kasich doing it, but I could see him also, you know, taking a different path and trying to find another way around the system. I think someone's going to do it. I would think almost certainly.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We have Tom joining us from Manchester. Tom, welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just listening to you guys talking about the retail politicking in New Hampshire. I'm curious how you would reconcile, I guess, what we might call the Trump phenomenon with our line in New Hampshire that, you know, you need to get out and meet the folks and shake the hands. And you're talking about Kasich, who probably did more town halls and meet and greets than anyone, and finished second. And Trump flies in on a 757, has a rally, and takes off again, and won fairly easily. Is this an aberration, or is it a mark of things to come, or what do you guys think?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. And Scott, we touched on this briefly at the beginning of the show, but I had planned to come back to it because I think it's a really interesting question. You know, the sort of the history and tradition of the primary is, you know, an outsider candidate kind of grinding it out like McCain or Carter or even Chris Christie, you know, until the last question is answered, and then you go to the Dunkin' Donuts and shake hands with people.
Right.
But here we have this sort of really unusual circumstance of, you know, Trump and Sanders winning, and as you and I have both experienced, that retail politics is really not, you know, in a sort of intimate one-to-one setting, obviously, is sort of not their thing. So you know, as Tom asks, is this an aberration, or is kind of the nature of the primary changing, do you think?
I think it's probably a little of both. I think, you know, the good news for New Hampshire is that it is somewhat of an aberration. I don't think you're ever going to get another candidate like Donald Trump that, again, by virtue of The Apprentice, by virtue of being someone that was in the public eye for so long, decades leading up to the primary, people just felt like they knew him. They felt comfortable with him. His voters did. He was a unique figure in so many ways. And, you know, you look at someone like, let's say, Ted Cruz, who ran kind of a similar campaign in New Hampshire, and that he didn't do, he did do some of the retail stuff, in fairness, you know, towards the end. But he wasn't in the state a whole
Cruz
lot.
Cruz was missing, I recall, for like long. Cruz and Rubio were both missing
Rubio
for long periods of time.
Rubio is another good example. You know, I think these guys, they did more retail stuff than Donald Trump did. Let's give them credit for that. But, you know, they had a hard time connecting in New Hampshire because, you know, I write about it in my book. I remember Ted Cruz's first event up here. He was in, you know, kind of a small pub trying to meet people. And he was wearing one of those headsets that televangelists wear when they're speaking to a crowd of 300, you know, 30,000 people. And it just seems so out of place. And I think people picked up on that. And Donald Trump, whatever you think about him, you know, people perceived him as being authentic because, you know, I think inarguably he goes up there and you know, kind of talks the way that he wants to talk. Yeah. And it comes off as being real, whether you agree with him or not. So that was appealing. Yeah. And then again, like, you know, he was a unique figure in so many ways. So that is somewhat of an aberration. But I think New Hampshire would be unwise to just discount the new environment that we're in,
right,
where, frankly, national media and the national conversation is more important than it's ever been before. Mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, you know, some of the local newspapers in the state, which, you know, I love and still love to read, and I know a lot of people do, their influence just isn't there anymore. I mean, the union leader's influence is not what it once was. And I think a lot of people are tuning into cable news, and they get their information that way. They're on social media, and those small-scale events aren't as important as they once were. So that's not to say that I do think that they still are important. I do still think that someone like, you know, Martin O'Malley, who was up here,
who was just here having house parties over the weekend.
Their only shot of doing well in New Hampshire is to do it the old-fashioned way. So you're still going to get candidates like that, but you're also going to get the candidates that are going to say, you know, Trump proved that we don't have to do that anymore. I think the answer is, again, somewhere in the middle, that the nature of the primary is changing a bit, and New Hampshire would be wise to acknowledge that, not pretend that it's not really happening, because it is, you know. But I do think that 2016 was somewhat of an aberration as well, and you know, hopefully it will revert a little bit back towards the norm in 2020.
Now, Tom, thanks again for that call. So it sounds like, in a way, you can, to some extent, explain Trump and Bernie Sanders as well, in the sense that the social media and cable and et cetera is almost priming voters with a virtual retail experience,
right,
that kind of subs for the shaking hands with them on the street.
Yeah, but again, like New Hampshire, you know, even though that's the case, I do still think, you know, and if we keep the system that we have heading into 2020 and forward, which I hope we do, it does still provide the opportunity for those unknown candidates who don't have the luxury of being talked about on CNN 24/7 like Donald Trump did. It doesn't mean that they're going to win in the end, but it gives them that chance. And without New Hampshire, they would have no chance at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, we need to take one more quick break, but coming up, more on what reporter Scott Conroy calls America's discerning, magnificent, and absurd road to the White House, otherwise known as the New Hampshire primary. So stay with us. You can join us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
It's not a reaction that can necessarily control. I guess I'd call it the ick factor.
Yeah. This week on Something Wild, prepare for the heebie-jeebies.
Garter snakes are more cold-tolerant than most snake species, and they actually can freeze for short periods of time. But if that freezing is an extended period of time, they actually will die. Winter mortality can be fairly high for garter snakes.
Chris Martin has the 411 on our slithering neighbors. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild, wherever you get your podcasts.
Boy, cool stuff.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, journalist Scott Conroy on his new book, Vote First or Die, about his year and a half covering the New Hampshire primary. And Scott will be appearing tonight at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College at 6 p.m. Scott is a journalist who's worked for The Huffington Post, Real Clear Politics, and CBS News. And Scott, we have an email here from Logan. And Logan says, what do you think about Rand Paul's 2016 performance in New Hampshire? Why wasn't he able to replicate his father Ron's near 23% share for 2012? And you know, for those of us who've been following this for a while, you know, Rand Paul is a pretty significant figure in recent New Hampshire electoral but Rand Paul wasn't quite able to replicate his father's experience.
Yeah. I actually write quite a lot about Rand Paul in the book. Because the window where I started spending a lot of time in New Hampshire leading up to 2016 began at the very beginning of 2015, and at that time, as you may recall, Rand Paul had been on the cover of Time magazine and was being called the most interesting man in politics, and there was just a lot of buzz around Rand Paul, both in New Hampshire and nationally. A lot of people thought that he would take that libertarian-leaning movement that his father really harnessed and expand it into some establishment support, and that he was a better politician than his dad ever was, and that he would just be a really formidable candidate to maybe win New Hampshire and ultimately the nomination. And he faded very fast, and I think this is a testament to the kind of old school regard for New Hampshire and the way that retail politics can make or break someone, because, you know, just spending a lot of time around Rand on the campaign trail in the early going, it just was very clear to me that this was not someone who liked campaigning. He didn't like to be around people. He didn't like to answer all their questions. He preferred to, he has some sort of a professorial air about him. He likes to talk about ideas and give kind of a lecture, but he's not someone that likes to go around and shake every hand in the room and make small talk and do those little things that the best politicians on the ground like to do. And I think that really did hurt him. So I think that Rand Paul is a good example of New Hampshire kind of still weeding out those candidates that don't do the small ball retail politicking very well.
We're talking about the New Hampshire primary on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Scott, I want to talk a little bit about the role of the media, both in New Hampshire and in the selection process more broadly. You started to touch on it a little bit before the last break. And you talk a bit about the danger of the national media narrative, especially with the debates. And I've seen this myself, especially I remember in 2012, there were a ton of debates where it was basically the front runner was whoever had done well at last week's cable news debate. So, You express some concern that this may overtake retail politics. You say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that the debates are more important now than ever. And there are so many of them, and people pay such close attention to them. And the media organizations that sponsor them, they're such cash cows for them that they hype them to such an incredible degree that you would almost think the debates are the elections themselves. So the debates, frankly, even the ones that take place in New Hampshire, they take place in the context of a national media focus, and they really do have a bigger impact. You know, the line used to always be that debates don't really matter that much, and I think 2016 certainly made clear that that is no longer the case. And I think as long as the cable news networks in particular continue to hype them to such a degree and to have so many of them, they are going to continue to be, you know, a huge factor going forward in the race. And I don't think that's necessarily a great thing. I mean, you can learn a lot from a candidate in debate sometimes, but it does take away from the old-fashioned kind of way that New Hampshire voters used to approach elections. And I think it's not a great thing.
Right. I want to ask you also about Trump specifically, and you have a couple some strong words for the news media regarding coverage of Trump, and then your own interesting experience with Huffington Post, in which as you were out in the field reporting, they decided to only post Trump stories in the entertainment section,
right,
which basically got you banned from the Trump campaign. But let's talk a little about this. I mean, the words you use in your book, you say that the TV news industry did a shameless capitulation to the Trump campaign in terms of how coverage went forward. Say a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, look, it's fundamentally, you know, as we all know, Donald Trump loves nothing more than to criticize and gripe about, and frankly go a lot further than that, the media. But it's certainly an ironic situation, considering that Donald Trump is entirely almost a creation of the media. And without the media, Donald Trump would not have ever become president. And it is inarguable to me that, especially in the early going of his campaign, you know, he was treated as this novelty that would kind of generate ratings for cable in particular over the summer and the doldrums when people aren't paying close attention. And, you know, that's fine. We've had candidates like that before, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, that were sort of treated as these big rising stars, and then they flamed out quickly, and, you know, someone that more of a quote-unquote normal candidate ends up getting the nomination in the end. With Trump, I think it became clear within a month or so of him running that he was different, and that he really did have staying power, and that he deserved to be treated as a serious candidate, and the scrutiny that comes with that. And I think, in particular, again, cable news really did a poor job in the early going of just providing sort of unedited airtime to him to a degree. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the amount of quote-unquote free media that Donald Trump got compared to the rest of the field is astounding. And that is worth millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars in the way that he was able to just dominate the conversation by virtue of the way that he was covered on cable. You know, his rallies were being shown from start to finish in a way that no other candidate's rallies would be. Mm-hmm. And you saw it at the end of the campaign. Harvard has this big symposium where they invite all the campaign managers to gather and sort of debrief and talk about what happened. And all of the campaign managers who were the campaign managers for other Republican candidates really just kind of unleashed on CNN in particular for the way that they covered Trump. And, you know, I think it's important for CNN in particular and the other cable networks to acknowledge the reality that they really did boost the guy in the early going, and I think they adjusted and they began covering him in a way that is now you know, irritated the president to such a degree. But it, to me, it's inarguable that without that early coverage, he wouldn't have had the staying power that he did.
Yeah, my pet peeve was the allowing him to phone in to the Sunday morning talk shows, which is not typically how it's done. And
because he was such a big get, and everyone wanted to hear more about Donald Trump, and so. You know, this was clearly a case where the considerations about ratings really trumped news judgment, news value, and fairness, frankly.
Right. Well, we have a couple emails here. Let's go first to an email from Nancy. And Nancy says, I feel slightly disloyal as a native Granite Stater to suggest this, but over time, wouldn't other states take primary responsibilities more seriously if they had an opportunity to go first in the primaries?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they would eventually, although I would caution, again, I use Nevada as a kind of a symbol of this. In 2008, the parties decided to move Nevada up to be one of the four so-called carve-out states that are allowed to go before anyone else. And especially on the Democratic side, it was seen as being very important because, you know, the Democratic primary electorate is very diverse. And Iowa, New Hampshire are very white states. So, you know, they wanted to have another state that is diverse. Nevada is very diverse, and it's a western state, which is different than all the others. And you know, it was the turnout and the interest on the Democratic side was higher in Nevada than it was on the Republican side. but it still wasn't very high. You know, I don't know, I don't have the numbers offhand, but the level of engagement was low. And now to the readers or the emailers' point, that probably would change eventually. But I think, you know, it's not, it's still going to take some time if that's the way that the parties ultimately decide to go, and there will be kind of a steep learning curve for all those states. So you're probably right that is true. But again, I think there's some value to what's already in place in the traditions of New Hampshire.
We're talking to author Scott Conroy about his new book, Vote First or Die. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange at nhpr.org. And Scott, Carolyn emails us, and she says, within the New Hampshire primary process, how does Scott see the 10% clause figuring in the process, winner takes it all? What's it like in other states? With the large field of candidates in 2016, must have been a major factor in the outcome.
The winner take all.
I assume she's talking about, you know, sort of proportional allocation versus winner take all for delegates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that doesn't, frankly, that doesn't matter as much in New Hampshire to me, because, you know, New Hampshire and Iowa in particular, yes, you want to win as many delegates as you can, and that ends up being important in a closely contested race for the nomination heading into the convention. But far more importantly than that is the media coverage that you get following your showing in New Hampshire. You know, a lot of people don't realize this, but in Iowa, it's really just the caucuses are really just a straw poll. They don't award delegates in Iowa until later on at the state convention. So it's, you know, and that doesn't diminish the importance of having a victory in Iowa. It's very important. So all of that is to say that in the early states, it's really just the media coverage that matters the most. It's not until you get later on where you have proportional allocation versus winner take all that actually matters more in the end. So I just don't think it's a hugely important issue.
Well, Nancy and Carolyn, thanks for those emails. I want to touch on one other theme that kind of, it sort of pops up in your book occasionally, although I don't sense you're pushing a particular reform agenda here, the issue of money in politics. And you kind of tell that story through your experience with Lawrence Lessig and the New Hampshire Rebellion and the issue of kind of walking around the state to raise awareness of money in politics. Say a little bit about this issue of money in politics and how you saw it play out in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, I did that walk. I did one leg of that walk with Lawrence Lessig's group in January 2015. They were trying to raise awareness for campaign finance reform. And it was, you know, northern New Hampshire in January. So it was an interesting 11 miles that I did that one day. A lot of people in the group were going far beyond that, so credit to them. And, you know, I talked to people in that group that were passionate about the issue. Bernie Sanders certainly brought it to the forefront of the conversation on the Democratic side. Lindsey Graham, actually, on the Republican side, talked about it from time to time and expressed some support for some more reform. It's not something that really, you know, took off in a way that I hoped it would, because I think it's a central issue, perhaps the central issue to why our politics have become so broken. And I think going forward, you know, a candidate from either party would be wise to latch onto that issue and to really bring it back into the conversation in a way that it was before, because, you know, there's probably 40,000-50,000 people, voters in New Hampshire, that are very strongly passionate about the issue. And so if you can really wrangle that support, John McCain in 2000 is a great example. You can actually have some electoral political payoff for it in a state like New Hampshire, as well as kind of just doing what I think is the right thing and advocating for campaign finance reform.
I'm curious, have you had any reaction to the book from, I know it just came out a week or two ago. Have you heard from any of the candidates or people? You know, you get a sense of reading this book that you got to know some of these folks pretty well.
Right. Yeah, no, I haven't heard from any of the candidates yet. I hope they read it. I'll give people a little time to actually read the book. But, yeah, no, I mean, I hope I wasn't afraid to call out some of the candidates when I thought that they were behaving ridiculously.
Sure.
So I'm sure some of them won't be thrilled with that. But I definitely, you know, tried to be fair in the book and go into it with an open mind regarding all the individual candidates. And I think, you know, as much as I criticize all of them at different points of the in the book, I think, you know, it is quite a grind and you know, an impressive feat for anyone to run for president, in particular in New Hampshire, where you really have to answer some tough questions from some pretty tough people. And also just the physical grind of it is unlike anything else. So, you know, it's good that we still have people that want to actually run for president, because I can't imagine doing it myself.
Right. So what comes next for you? You've got this book. You're going to be talking about it for a while. Then what?
Yeah. I have this scripted TV series called Embeds, which airs on Verizon's platform called Go90, which you can access by downloading an app on your phone, Go90 app, or you can go to their website, go90.com. And we actually shot that in Iowa, which was a lot of fun and kind of a new experience for me. But my wife and I are moving out to Los Angeles and then getting involved in some other scripted projects. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the next step for me.
So we're not going to see you back here in 2020?
You'll see me back. I'm sure I would love to come back in 2020 for sure. And you'll see me tonight.
That's right.
At
the NHIOP at 6. Yep.
Yeah, 6 o'clock at the Institute of Politics tonight. I'm about to get on a flight and head up to New Hampshire. But yeah, I mean, I will definitely come back, and I hopefully it will be as more of a political tourist, or maybe I'll have another book in the works, but probably not as a reporter. I've done it 3 times now, and that feels like enough for me.
Well, your book also works well as a travelogue of all the best coffee shops in New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, you know, when I originally talked about the idea for the book with my publisher, we talked about how we wanted to feel kind of like travel writing, actually.
Yeah.
So hopefully people will enjoy it. It's kind of a, you know, a breezy, lighthearted look at the state, and it will give you some good ideas for places to get coffee or a beer, hopefully, too.
Well, Scott Conroy, thank you so much for joining us for the exchange today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
That's Scott Conroy. He's author of the new book, Vote First or Die, The New Hampshire Primary, America's Discerning, Magnificent, and Absurd Road to the White House. Scott's also co-creator and executive producer, as he just mentioned, of Embeds on Verizon's Go90 platform. He's previously worked for The Huffington Post, Real Clear Politics, and Vice. He joined us from Washington, D.C. And remember, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.